All right, welcome back. We're here in week 7. We are just about at the midway point, and we had a great conversation last week, really kind of digging deep into the comical question I asked, which was, you know, does capital work for you? And we learned a ton of things, including that CDs have multiple meanings, which was, of course, my favorite. That was my favorite part. But we also learned some really valuable information about the challenges of working capital, the challenges of forecasting, and really, you know, I think we really brought a lot of big ideas to light. And also, Kathy, you did a great job last week of really kind of helping us understand what happens if we don't have enough working capital. And you talked about the different ways that we can leverage financing to ensure that we can continue to grow at a healthy level. So as I was reflecting on our wonderful conversation, as I normally do, and just as a reminder, I'm not a finance major. I've never taken a finance course. I don't remember a thing about accounting class or personal finance class in high school, other than, you know, credit cards are the devil. but just kind of remind us again about kind of those key points about working capital and the difference between working capital and you know, current assets.
Well, when we're talking about working capital, it really is primarily made up of, you know, these current assets, these things that are liquid that constantly move through. Top one is cash. You know, if we don't have enough cash to pay our bills and to pay our employees, we're obviously going to have a problem. We're going to have to go borrow money, pay interest on that, or maybe even sell off other liquid investments that we have. If we did have some marketable securities, we might have to do that to generate cash, or even worse. But you know, that working capital is a and those current assets are a critical piece that all business owners have to manage. Large companies, this happens very, that have a solid relationship with the bank, this is not a big deal, although it's possible to have too much cash, for example, you know, and if a company has too much cash and they get a little bit sloppy and overconfident, they might actually miss opportunities on investing that cash and generating, you know, additional earnings. And clearly, if you're doing too much of that, you're going to lower your overall return, you know, or profitability for the company. So cash bears watching all the time. It's that important.
You know, I've heard the term cash is king, but you're really giving us a new light about cash. I mean, it almost seems like the more cash you have, the better. But now you're saying there's definitely a point where it's too much. So is there a sweet spot? Just like, you know, we think of it like in tennis, like that sweet spot. Does that exist with cash?
Well, you know, if I'm looking at my cash budget, I can actually, you know, look at it last two or three years, forecast through my sales projections. I can get a sense of what this is going to look like. I can, even if I'm really smart, I can kind of see, you know, when are the biggest gulps of cash coming out of my business? You know, what time of the month do my customers typically pay? You know, and I've seen business owners who were brilliant at knowing exactly when cash was coming in. Small business owners, you know, sometimes seem magical with that kind of a gift. So you can actually use that information to figure out, you know, what's this going to look like throughout our year or throughout our quarter, which is kind of likely, or maybe it's the seasonal big influxes, you know, that I have to be wary of. Most companies have that line of credit that handles that. I dip into it, that automatically takes care of it. You saw that example in some of our homework in the cash budgeting example. So that's, you know, probably the easiest way to think of how we deal with cash throughout the year.
Well, it's a really interesting point that you made about how we deal with, you know, cash throughout the year, and just, you know, the magic sixth sense that people have knowing when cash is going to come in. So that's really helpful. I appreciate you, you know, going back into that, but also answering that question, even though it was kind of a random question. Is there a sweet spot with the right amount of cash? I mean, I guess there is no such thing as that, but
yeah.
What about with e-commerce? So one of the things that I think a lot about is, you know, that with a store, you kind of have an idea, right? Of like, okay, you know, we know that we've got, you know, X amount of this in inventory. But now when you start thinking about e-commerce, that makes things a little bit trickier. I mean, Amazon has warehouses where they can control that inventory. But when it comes to e-commerce, you might just get hit with a huge, you know, let's say your product. I know this wouldn't be necessarily relevant for smart manufacturing, but let's say, you know, there's a company here in Indiana that gets free advertising on Oprah. You know, they might have an influx on their website of e-commerce. So how does the cash flow cycle kind of expedited through e-commerce, or what problems that cause?
Oh my gosh, you reminded me of, absolutely, crises can occur by things like that. You know, I had some friends who were offered some business with Walmart at one time, and they said, oh my gosh, that would be a huge crisis for us. And they said, please, and I was consulting with them, and they said, please don't think badly of us if we turn down Walmart. And I'd say, no, I would call that wisdom, because you know what kind of demands they're going to make. And by the way, they do costing for logistics. They do costing, you know, for how this stuff is packaged and what size it has to be on their shelves. I mean, yeah, no, these people were really wise. Maybe wiser than they even knew when they made that decision. So you do have to plan. But e-commerce can be a huge boon, but just like anything else, it has to be managed and planned for. You better forecast and better do a little bit of test marketing with who you are aiming that e-commerce at to see what kind of results. My experience is typically marketing doesn't work that fast, but e-commerce is a different animal. It can, if you hit, like you said, the right sweet spot, you've got the right product. And of course, look, when we're selling for e-commerce, whether it's a physical product we're selling or maybe even a digital product, you know, some sort of an app or, you know, a book or some advice of some sort, you know, all kinds of, you know, I buy sheet music all the time online, and it's an instant download. You know, your idea is you want to shorten the amount of time between making the investment in that product, the business expenses you incurred between making those and also investing in your e-commerce effort, right? Because that takes a lot of planning. I mean, you want to shorten the amount of time between making that investment and getting back your money, having sold it, and getting paid for it, right? Better yet, you get paid up front, like Dell is a great example. You and I buy Dell computers online. We send them the money. They've got our money. Now, they don't have a manufacturing plant, by the way. They hire third-party people to make those, and so they deposit that cash. They send their little deal off of their probably system integrators out there that are making these computers for them. We get it sometimes as soon as 48 hours, right? And they don't have to pay those guys for another 30 days. Mm-hmm. What a sweet deal is that? You know, you can make money if you know what to do with it. You know, beer distributors, they get their money up front too. You know, Chinese restaurants get their money up front. There's some great businesses out there like that. But, you know, kidding aside, if you make too much product, you overstock it and nobody's buying, you're losing money in a couple of ways: lack of sales and trying to recover dollars that you just paid in making those unsold items. So you've got a lot to think about here when you're going out with e-commerce. I can't, you know, stress enough that planning is the big part. Test markets, you know, I hadn't even thought about it that way, but I think you do need to know what you're doing. Maybe even have a backup plan where you can get those in a hurry from somebody else, perhaps somebody who can be a third-party manufacturer for you if you really needed it. A similar problem can come up with digital problems, and clearly you're going to have to take a while so you could run. You know, by the way, these ideas I'm talking about probably aren't new to you. You cut costs where you can. If you have to sell more than you do the classic sale on the physical products or digital products, you know, discounts. Every time I hit a link for a product I'm interested, they're going to make you fill this out and they're going to promise you 25% off of your first order. Better yet, if you sign up and register for our brand new, you know, custom club, whatever, that you can get these things on an eternal discount, right? And they all have them of some sort or another. I've just, you know, had to to buy something on Walmart. Now, it's not guaranteed 2 days for no fee. They're playing the same game as and I didn't even click on it. It's like, oh, dear God, no. I'm a Prime person. I'm paying my money to them annually. And by the way, I get my money's worth out here. You know, I'm on a first name basis, and my dog barks when the trucks go by because she knows she'll get a treat. and I'm not kidding. You know, so we're getting our money's worth out of that money we spend with Prime. I'm not going to do it with anybody else. That's the kind of thing you watch out for. But you have to be careful. You've got to organize your expenses too. I mentioned following revenue patterns. Here's another one. You know, this is just true in terms of managing cash in general. You know, the truth is you want to try to collect early and pay late. You know, now that sounds oxymoronic because, you know, clearly, yeah, collect early, we get it. Even better if you can collect it ahead like Dell. And lots of people used to give the 2% 10 discounts. There's still of that around for manufacturers. And, you know, and they know exactly what they're doing. They're making their money. And by the way, if you're offered a discount, we'll look at that next chapter. You'll see why it's definitely worth it to take it and pay in the 10 days or 15 days, whatever it is. But so, if you've got really good relationships with your vendors, there's nothing, you know, sometimes they don't expect you to pay within 30 days. Most do. Manufacturers typically get paid well. But you can ask for longer payment terms. Yeah, they may or may not charge you interest depending on how good of a customer you are. So if you have a really good relationships, negotiate with them if you need more time to pay. During those really big gulps of the year, if they're a big piece of that supply chain and you're getting, you know, they're getting a lot of extra sales for them, why wouldn't they allow you to perhaps pay a little later? You also, in marketing, since you brought this up in the context of e-commerce, you're going to have to stay quick on your feet. With marketing social media, you have to really watch who your targeted audience is, where they're going. Are they into Facebook? Maybe they've moved to TikTok. You know, don't ask me much about this. I just see what my kids send me in terms of funny things with TikTok. I can't get addicted to TikTok, you know, and I can't waste my time on any of those platforms. But you're going to have to know them and stay relevant and effective on whatever channels you're moving through. Speaking of channels, you know, if you're on a marketing channel and you're not getting the return on investment you expected, scale back or move to another channel. You know, keep remembering to boost those promotions, do everything you can. Last thing I'm going to say about this is, and you know, we don't think about this as often as an end user concern mode, but when I spend a lot of time with manufacturers and distributors, both, increasing your average order value is a big deal. Distributors in particular have this small order problem, and you can spend your life fulfilling small orders and wasting a ton. By the way, Amazon is now trying to combine shipments with you to solve the same kind of a problem, right? So, you know, that's where things like, we'll pay for your shipping if you get to $150 order. They're trying to increase that average order size. By the way, that makes you more efficient. You know, it gets you more cash at one time. It's a much better way to move more inventory over time. All of those can play into this. How do I enhance my cash flow, work better with e-commerce, whatever your problems are. It's worth to think about those things.
So, I mean, it sounds like we're kind of moving into a whole new facet of smart manufacturing, which is the scheduling and planning component of it, in terms of how you get the most product, you know, get the most product at the right time, you know, for the right money. I mean, I call it just in time manufacturing. It's just having everything ready when you need it, but being able to, I mean, essentially, right? You have a crystal ball, and you're basically ready when those orders come in, and you know what orders are coming in, and you're finding a way to, like you said, right, get paid early and pay things out late, so you have that time in between. I mean, does that sound, is that kind of like the scheduling and planning component of smart manufacturing, or?
It is. Now, when you bring in JIT, I'm going to have to stop and define that, because it was really designed to help manufacturers reduce heavy inventory related costs by getting materials and goods only when they're really needed. Imagine your manufacturers like Big Lots, they want to do truckload out, but what about that raw material that's going to go right into work in process? They don't want warehouses and warehouses full of that, you know, and they've come a long way in order to, you know, get those right when they need them. Not a bad deal. But what about a time like this where we've got problems? There are huge potential problems with just-in-time situations. You got a risk of running out of stock, you know. With JIT, you don't keep as much stock. For good reason, by the way. It reduces space management. You know, you need smaller investments. That reduction of the permanent fixed assets we talked about, right, in raw materials. You know, if I can get them to deliver that just in time, like say every time I have a big new production run, boom, here it comes. I don't have to worry about, you know, paying for a much larger group of raw material that's going to come in that might be last me a month or two. Not to mention the chance for that to get damaged out there if it's in my warehouse for that long, or God forbid, become obsolete. And lots of your products out there, obsolescence is huge, right? Some, I work with electronics suppliers, sometimes 6 months, sometimes can be, you know, the length of a what's considered the life of a product, because they just are moving so fast. So you see why we do just in time, it's a very big advantage. On the other hand, the risk, and right now a whole lot of that's happening. We can run out of stock, you know, carry as much. So I don't, what if I get a big order, big opportunity, I grow real fast, getting that new, relationship I have with my vendors, I might not be able to respond as quickly. So I depend on those suppliers for everything and their timeliness, right? Every order puts you at risk of delaying that customer's receipt of goods. And if I don't have those products when I need them, I may have end users on just in time with me, by God, and they know when they need it. They may have a production, a construction plant going on. You never know what's going on. So yeah, absolutely. Your point about planning is absolutely true. It's critical.
Well, I really appreciate you being so thoughtful about just in time. It sounds like a great idea, but then a pandemic hits and suddenly everyone is rushing to get chips. Oh, by the way, we don't have the infrastructure for that. So good luck, right? Yeah, we've beat that horse a few times, right?
We are.
But I mean, there are other things too, including, you brought up a lot of the factors, obviously, which I think is important. But let's, you know, shift gears and talk about inflation as well. I mean, how do you prepare, or at least how do you handle that? Because I mean, you only have so many assets available. You only have so much capital that you can do at once. And what happens if, like in a time right now when inflation just boom is going to skyrocket? How do you handle that? Because you can't just say, okay, well, even though we said we're only going to charge you $30 a part, now with inflation that's like $33. So we're just gonna you can't change that, right?
No, you can't. What you can do is to look at some of your policies. I mean, we do have very interesting situation right now. So you asking me about, you know, inflation. What happens to that? And I'll relay this to inventory policy, because we make money with that inventory and it comes in at a given price. Right? Every time you add an item to your inventory, the value of that inventory goes up or down by the cost you paid for it. So what happens when inflation is high? Costs are rising rapidly. You're going to end up with items in that inventory that you paid different costs for, sitting next to identical items. And you can actually have three or four different items in your inventory that you purchased at very different costs, particularly at a time when inflation is extremely high. Now, so that comes, what about inventory methods or policies? You know, we hear of FIFO and LIFO. I jokingly talk about, yeah, one's the name of the dog, one's the name of the dog food.
I love that, no, by the way. That better show up on an exam.
Yeah.
As a trick question, what is it really? It's dog food.
FIFO, first in, first out. We buy that. That means we ship it out first. More importantly, whether it's the actual product or not, it's the value of that product that we LIFO, by the way, is last in, first out, the last thing we bought for. Now, if I'm trying to really figure out what's going on in my market today, right, LIFO can give me a highest estimate of a cost of goods sold among that approach. By the way, I could do a weighted average as well, but just for example's sake, let's talk about FIFO or LIFO, because right now our inflation is big enough. You're going to have to understand this. FIFO, first in, first out, can enhance the value of remaining inventory and bring you a higher net income. In fact, it tends to be the most popular inventory accounting method because it gives you the most accurate view of costs and it can enhance profitability. LIFO might, the very last though, gives us the most realistic net income because it matches current costs to current revenues. It's what's happening today, right? So you really have to take a look at your own situation, where you are, what is your historical cost? Do I need those higher revenues? You know, I don't think either, you know, your accountant is the one who's going to have to tell you what have you been doing in the past, what are the laws and of the land, general accounting principles say about this. You know, I'm thinking back to probably 75 years ago when a whole lot of companies, oil companies, got in trouble because they just switched between FIFO and LIFO at will whenever it can make them more money. Didn't go over too well.
How come?
Well, because they were manipulating the market to make more money. You know, they could at will change their price in the marketplace based on...
Got it.
Yeah, does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, sorry. I just want to make sure that was clear to
That's
our
all
listeners.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And you know, look, the costs of inflation right now are crazy to us. You know, this really interesting, and I've been reading about this for weeks. Ketchup. You know what's going on with ketchup? People couldn't find it because they were selling in these bottles, and so much takeout was going out by the restaurants, a lot of people were eating out. Especially after COVID and the restaurants opened back up, boom, everybody wants it. Before that, they were going after the little sachets of this. And so they literally had to redo all their production to increase their production of the little sachets, you know, by 30%, you know. Maybe not a bad deal, because if you're running out of ketchup and you can move more of it that way, okay. And by the way, on a price per sachet value, every time you change your production, you all see this with groceries. You know, you notice people changing their packaging in order to make more money. You know, they've got a competitor, so okay, now we'll get the per use item, and man, they can make a lot more cash doing that than they can by their big, you know, bulky boxes of what they used to be selling.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because my favorite sachet is actually at Chick-fil-A. They have the best way of doing it. You can open up the ketchup thing in two different ways. You can pull it open, and then you can dip your fry in it, or you can use it as like a little squirter, and you can like squirt it on. So when you say sachet to our listening audience, you know, that's a very fancy term, I think, for a packet.
A packet of ketchup.
It's a packet. Well, you kept calling it sachet. I'm like, I don't think they know what that word means. I don't know what that word means, Kathy.
Or fry sauce at Freddy's, you know? We're all about the fry sauce at Freddy's.
I thought you were going to say Arby's, but yeah, I know what you're talking about. Arby's has...
Go right ahead.
We need to seek out sponsorships. This is off the cuff. We're not like, you know, we're not getting paid every time we...
We are not getting paid. Doggone it.
But I think you bring up... Well, I know you bring up a valuable point, but I think there's multiple points here that I think is really interesting, is that, you know, we're talking about inflation, and then you're like, Adam, inflation is one part of this never-ending moving target. And so there's just so much to think about. But again, I just go back to this idea of who really has the crystal ball then. I mean, who really knows what's going on? I mean, I'll never forget, and I hope you find this comical. I think this is hilarious. So my cousin, you know, he's... At the Ohio State University, you know, gets a great degree, comes home for Thanksgiving, and tells me all about how Peloton and Grubhub are overrated, and that, you know, his professor said these are a bubble, blah blah blah. This was the Thanksgiving before COVID, Kathy. What happened to Peloton and Grubhub? You know what happened.
Oh my Lord.
But they didn't have a crystal ball. I mean, at the time, people were saying, you guys are crazy, and then the market changes and suddenly everybody is fluctuating and trying to build these new packages or build these new boxes, but nobody's ready for it. And so I think it's a really interesting case study in asset management, because now, you know, these companies that, you know, are struggling, they have to use what they have to make the adjustments they need to make in order to still make money.
Right. Absolutely. And that can come in every form that you could name, you know, and what goes up will come down too, you know, and I've said it before related to stock prices. It's true, certainly true, probably with inflation and the prices across the market. I mean, all of us probably witnessed huge increases in lumber. They've started to come down some. I've got a son works, sells, electrical supplies, you know, great business, but he just literally sent me a text yesterday. 3 years ago, PVC was selling for 70 and a half, 100 feet. Now it is almost $400 per 100 feet. So these are crazy times related to inflation.
So then how long does it take for those numbers to hit us as the consumer or the manufacturers? Because they hit the manufacturers first, but then they have to recoup that money, right?
Well, they're hitting us now. If you're trying to build a house or commercial construction of any kind, those are totally changing. I got lots of friends who are just stopping on any, you know, house, anything, you know, even including some just remodels in their home because the prices of all of these different, by the way, if you can get them, they're going to be grossly expensive, but you can't get them right now either. So some of you will be listening to this in the future and going, yeah, well, that lasted, you know, only 6 months, or yeah, we're still in it. You know, we don't know, Adam, we just don't know.
Well, that's a really good point. But, you know, the interesting thing, though, is that it really is a supply and demand. And so when they're even at that price, there's still a huge demand for it. So people are still willing to pay it. But it is interesting to see how that cost gets divvied out between, you know, the supplier, the distributor, the manufacturer, all that stuff. I mean, because we all have to pay for it at some point, right? It's all going to affect our bottom line.
Yeah, it will trickle down.
Trickle down. That's, yeah, that the trickle down.
I'm not going to politics. But
there's a type of, yeah, look, Google trickle down economics. Is it trickle
or
down?
Or better yet, don't.
Well, regardless, no. Kathy was not saying to go down that political black hole, but I was.
You know, look, costs, you know, at the higher ends of those channels all end up affecting costs that we pay across the board.
You know, while you're Googling that, you should also look up Voodoo Economics from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. But okay, so joking aside, so let's wrap this up. So this is a really important, I think this is important for our learners to know. So last week, right, we were talking about working capital, and now we've switched gears to talk about current asset management. But are those separate, or are those just two facets of a bigger gear or a bigger set of cogs?
Current assets are the working capital in a very real sense. If you're looking at cash, you've got to have cash, you've got to have inventory, and you've got to have your accounts receivables are in there, right? And plenty of other payables and various expenses that go in there. Of course, the money that you pay your employees is in there. So that literally is working capital. And if I don't, the cash that I use is right there in those current assets, as is the inventory, as is the accounts receivables. You know, so there it is. You know, they generally do match. Current assets are the working capital of the world.
And so it's really just figuring out how to play three-card Monty to ensure that everything is where it needs to be at the right time.
Right.
Perfect. Oh, good. Okay, great. So it's that easy. Just shuffle it around, right?
Right. Right.
Oh, my goodness. Well, as always, very informative, very helpful. And as a constant reminder, I have no finance background whatsoever. So I am learning this as we're going through it. And I hope this is helpful for you as well, to have a novice ask these questions, or to have novices ask these questions to ensure that. But as always, Kathy, great examples. Thank you for your time. Thank you for helping me understand there are no right or wrong answers, but instead it's about strategic decisions and doing the best you can with what you have access to. But also, can I say too, a really important thing that you brought in today that I don't think I picked up on, partnerships. I mean, it really sounds like the more that you can partner with different vendors, different suppliers, yes, distributors, and work with them, It gives you more decisions.
It absolutely gives you a lot more options. The more congruent that your objectives are within those channels that you operate with, the more just the more time that you spend with them, the better those relationships, you know. And we could talk all day about enhancing, you know, those relationships from, you know, paying your vendors on time and obviously meeting your obligations of all kinds with your key customers. But you're right, Adam, you know, sometimes those relationships aren't great. Sometimes people are beating each other up on prices and or delivery and or payment terms. And in the long run, those generally don't pay off very well for a cooperative long-term relationship where there's a high degree of respect between partners in those channels. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because it's critical if you're going to have good relationships. Good business relationships are obviously critical to doing good business. Excuse me, I can't talk here.
Well, you brought it up. I just made sure that people heard it.
Thank you.
Well, no, I think, you know, partnerships are very important, and I think it's good to remember you can have those relationships. But I think it's also important to remember, yeah, the LIFO, FIFO, it's not as easy. You can't switch those things around sometimes, and it is not dog food. So that I think is really important too, to keep in mind. So thank you for that. I appreciate that. And as sure. Always, always fun to talk about these concepts.
All right. Thank you. It's been fun to be with you.